You are listening to the 2018 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust Leadership Advance Conference. This year's conference theme was Listening to Wisdom, Hearing the Voices of Our Great Cloud of Witnesses. The second session is led by John Yates.
When Steve Moore asked me to come and speak, I wondered, well, sure, but why me? It sounded as though he wanted me to speak about wisdom and leadership. Honestly, I don't think about myself as being wise or particularly an exceptional leader. Now, if he'd asked my wife to come and speak, I would have understood. Actually, it was my wife who said, oh, honey, you have to do that. She said, I'll go with you. We'll do that little conference, and then we'll have 3 or 4 days in some romantic place in the Northwest, and it'll be great. And I said, oh, that sounds really good. So I'm here by myself. Last month, our daughter asked her if she would like to go to France and visit our granddaughter, who's over there studying abroad. And so, you know how it is. You've got to choose between your husband and your grandchildren. Well, she leaves for France tomorrow. So here we are. I'll do my best without my bride. So I want to talk to you about wise leadership, what it is, and some thoughts about growing in wisdom. And if you'll let me, just at the outset, I'd like to tell you just 2 minutes about our story. It will help you see where I'm coming from. My wife and I moved to the Washington area 40 years ago. 5 little children called to a historic church in Northern Virginia, invited to try and bring renewal to a church in decline. My first Sunday at that church, I met the retired Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was sitting on the back pew. And on the front pew, I met a member of the U.S. Congress who prided himself for never having missed a vote in Congress. He had been in Congress more years than I had lived. I was 32 years old. I had never led a church before. You think you need to learn about leadership? I really did. We've had a surprising 40 years in Washington. When my wife and I were first married, we felt called by God to commit ourselves to work with all our might for renewal in our old denomination, the denomination that we had grown up in. And we saw true renewal in pockets, but we saw the denomination continue to decline and to lurch further and further away from biblical Christianity. And it finally reached the point after 15 or 20 years in Falls Church where we just couldn't be a part of that denomination. It had gone so far in its embrace of modernism. And so folks like us had just been marginalized. So 95% of the people in our church said we should leave. So we pulled out of the denomination. Then we were sued, and we experienced 7 years of litigation about the ownership of the property. And we finally lost. We really lost. We lost everything. We lost our house. We lost our church. We lost all the money that had been given for missions, whatever. The only good thing about it was that there were a lot of us, and we were together, and we had each other. So I've stayed on there a lot longer than I imagined I would, but next summer I'm going to step aside, and a wonderful young man is going to take my place. I'm looking forward to that. But honestly, I could stay on forever and never finish my job. I tell people, when I went to Washington, God said my job was to chase the devil out of Washington. And I have job security, believe me. So I've wondered about and have attempted to learn about effective leadership for years. And leadership is easier to describe than to define. A leader is a person with a vision that he or she can articulate effectively. She has passion for that vision, and as a result, others will buy into it and follow so that the vision is accomplished. And wise leadership is something else, and wise Christian leadership is still another thing. And it seems to me that wise Christian leadership is the ability to bring others together to accomplish things that are pleasing to God and are for the good of creation and for the good of humanity. So I've prayed and pastored and preached to Washingtonians for a long time. And I've learned there's a big difference between leadership as it is understood in Washington these days, and what we would call kingdom leadership. And what I want to say to you as leaders is seek wisdom from any source you can find it, but especially seek kingdom wisdom. The wise leaders that I learned most from, I met in my 20s. Most of them are dead now. There have been good leaders in Washington and some who practiced kingdom leadership there at the national level, but not many. And there are fewer now than there once were. Leadership is difficult, and at the national level, especially in politics, most who attempt it don't last very long. Back in 1986, a book came out in Washington entitled The Wise Men, Six Friends and the World They Made. It was a fascinating look at six American leaders who had an extraordinary influence on America and our foreign policy since World War II. People like Averell Harriman and Dean Acheson. These people, they were two diplomats, two bankers, and two lawyers, but they foresaw that America would have to assume a global role and shape a new world order. And they left a legacy that still has a dominant influence on American policy. They were the brightest and best. They were at the height of their influence in the 50s, but they still influence us. But the reason I mention them is that I had to go back pretty far to find leaders at the national level that could be described as wise men. I can't remember the word wisdom being used, commonly applied to many of our national leaders in the past 20 years. Certainly we have had some wise leaders, and we have some wise leaders still. However, the sorts of words that we hear used to describe our leaders in the nation's capital now are words like pushy, strong, powerful, confident, uncompromising. A few years ago, we would have heard words like inspirational, strategic, persuasive, adaptive. The trend isn't altogether encouraging. So you have to be on the lookout for wisdom. I love a story about a man who was a principal of a middle school. And this was a wise man, but he's having a problem with a few of the older girls who were starting to use lipstick. And so when they applied it in the bathroom, they would press their lips to the mirror. I don't know why women did that, but they did. And they would leave their lip prints, and before long it got out of hand. And the principal was trying to think of a way to stop it. He gathered all the girls who wore lipstick together at 2 o'clock one afternoon in the bathroom, and they gathered together. They found the principal and the school custodian there. And the principal explained that this was becoming a real problem for the custodian to clean the mirror every night. And he said he felt the ladies didn't fully understand what a problem this was, and he wanted them to witness just how hard it was to clean the mirror. The custodian then demonstrated. He took a long brush with a long handle. He dipped the brush in the nearest toilet, and then he moved to the mirror, and he proceeded to clean the mirror. That was the last day those girls pressed their lips against the mirror. Now, that was a wise man, for sure. I don't think I've ever met anyone who was born wise. It's true that God does give wisdom to some people as a gift of wisdom, but it has to be cultivated. Wisdom has to be learned. And you can be good morally, ethically strong, but wisdom is more than that. You may have learned all the rules of good conduct that your parents taught you. You may have a wealth of knowledge in your head, but these are not the same thing as wisdom. Years ago, a well-known scientist named Max Born, he was a great friend and colleague of Albert Einstein, many of the other great physicists of that day, and in an interview on television before he died, this world-famous scientist made this statement. He said, "I'd be happier if we had scientists with less training but more wisdom." There's so much in life that requires more than knowledge or a set of rules. I mean, for instance, if we purchase this building, should we trust that we'll be able to have enough tenants to make the mortgage payments? How do we know? Or should I quit this job and take that job, even though I'm not sure I'm going to really like that job? Or should I let my kids spend time with those wild and disruptive kids down the cul-de-sac? Should I hire this person, even though the team isn't agreed about her? Or the one I always struggle with is, how in the world am I going to explain this to the staff? Life is made up of questions that require wisdom. You can have rules for all sorts of situations, and you can read books and attend seminars and gain knowledge to be much better equipped to deal with life's challenges. But most of life's questions that will be most important for us will require wisdom that we can't get from a book or a seminar. I know we live in the information age, but knowledge is plentiful, but real wisdom is rare. And some of you right here, right now, are probably frustrated and weighed down because you're in a situation and you just don't have the wisdom to know how to deal with it. You know, if you're raising children, a major responsibility is to teach them right and wrong. And to do that when they're small, you have to teach them the rules, what we must do and the things that we don't do ever. Children have to learn obedience when they're young. But then as they get older, they need to learn the why behind the rules we teach. And so we have to talk to them about life and God and tell them that God says certain things are right and certain things are wrong. And then they need to learn why God says some things are right and some things are wrong. They have to learn the consequences of bad choices. But even that isn't the same thing as wisdom. Wisdom means you know the best thing to do, and you do it. And few people have that sort of maturity. The way I understand wisdom is that it just means the ability to successfully master life. And if I understand it correctly, in the book of Proverbs, wisdom is presented in three different lights. First, it's the quality of knowing how things really are. To understand among all the confusing clues in life how things really are, what's really true, what's right. And then second, wisdom is sound judgment. It's to be insightful, not just to how things are, but as to how things really work, how things come about in life. And then third, the wise person not only knows how things really are and how things really happen, but it means knowing what to do about it. And that's the quality you want in your leaders. And you see it in Solomon when the two women come to him with one baby, both claiming to be the mother. He understood how things were. One was the mother and one was lying. And he knew how things worked. The true mother would never allow her child to be killed, so he knew what to do. He threatened to have the child sliced in two and half the child given to one, half given to the other, knowing that the real mother would refuse to let it happen. Well, that's wisdom. A good auto mechanic knows how to put things together in an engine, and he knows how things work. So if the engine's broken, he knows what's needed to repair it. That's mechanical wisdom. There's also relational wisdom and spiritual wisdom and moral wisdom, all of which we desperately need to make right choices, which make life work as God intends it to for you and me. So every day we need wisdom or we're going to make serious mistakes. I don't know about you, but over the years I've known a few people who possess that sort of wisdom. And when you meet a truly wise person, you want to sit and talk with them because they know how life is and how life works and how to make the best decisions. Many years ago, it was over 40 years ago now, I lived across the street from an older man who possessed that sort of wisdom. And I would sit with him and talk every Friday afternoon, week in and week out. And he took an interest in me and he asked me questions, but mostly it was about me asking him questions and listening to him tell me stories and share his wisdom with me. And it's difficult for me to tell now just how valuable that was to me as a young 28-year-old man. And when he died, it was an irreparable loss for me. Well, you'd like to have a friend like that, wouldn't you? Wouldn't it be tremendous to have a personal relationship with somebody who's truly wise and you can learn from? Well, as Sandy mentioned earlier, in Proverbs 8, wisdom is presented as a person who calls out to us. And Christians, of course, believe that wisdom is a person. John chapter 1 is partially based on Proverbs 8, and those famous first verses about "in the beginning was the Word" could be translated this way: "In the beginning was wisdom, and the wisdom was with God, and the wisdom was God. And wisdom became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory, glorious from the only Son, from the Father, full of grace and truth." The wisdom of God became a person. St. Paul said in 1 Corinthians that Christ is the wisdom of God. He became to us wisdom from God. If you want true wisdom, you look to Jesus. You study His life. You ponder His words and wisdoms. You're amazed at His answers, at His questions, at His life. He lived the life of perfect wisdom. And He still lives. And if we entrust ourselves to Him, He gives us His Holy Spirit to be our wise counselor. The wisdom of Christ is especially seen in the cross. As Paul says, foolishness to the world, but the wisdom of God is seen nowhere as it is in the cross. I love St. Paul's words in Colossians 2 when he spoke about Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So, obvious, but getting to know Him must be a top priority for us if we want to be truly wise leaders from God's perspective. I hope we all make time to read and study the Scriptures daily. I don't know if anything is important in gaining wisdom. And I've tried over the years, whatever I'm reading, also to be in the Gospels most days, as well as other parts, because I always want to be looking at Jesus, looking at His words, looking at His decisions, looking at His actions, looking at His relationships, looking at what made Him angry, what made Him glad. Why did He enjoy parties so much? Asking, what are the principles that underlies life? What truths were the things that guided Him? And so I encourage you, as you pray for wisdom, go to wisdom Himself. And I'd say also, read for wisdom. I read a lot, I expect most of us do. But now I'm at the point where I'm cleaning out my books. You know what it's like? Over the years, you collect so many books. And all these shelves, and I've got to turn my office and my study over to someone else within the next year. So I'm looking at all these books. And every week now, I'm putting them out on a table. John Yates giveaway books. And if you want some books, here they are. Every week I'm putting them out. I'm planning to give away hundreds of books. There are a few authors who you'll really love and who are also able to help you grow in wisdom, aren't there? Those are the ones to read. For me, there are many, but it would be above all would be John Stott and C.S. Lewis. And a novelist like Wendell Berry. Talk about wisdom and relationships and values. Wendell Berry, when I read him, I just reread last week, I just finished reading his novel, Jaber Crow, about a man who grows old and grows wise. And it is an amazing story, Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry. But when I read Berry, he makes me want to be good. He makes me want to be moral. He makes me want to be responsible. But somebody like that, you just got to read. So I'm looking at all my books now and wishing I hadn't bought so many. There are some classics that I'll keep, you know, Les Miserables, Jane Eyre, and the classics. I'll keep those, and I'll keep my biographies. Most of my books now, though, I'm trying to get rid of. I remember asking John Stott once about books. And I said, who should I read? And he looked at all of my books. And he knew I was a preacher. He said, spend your money on commentaries, John. That's all he said. He was a wise man. You want to add daily to the deposit of wisdom in your life. Watch what you read. But above all, find wise people and hang out with them. I learned that wise leaders don't look alike, they don't act alike, they don't operate alike. I want to tell you briefly about two who had a profound impact on me, again, when I was young. We were living in Pittsburgh, and I was working for a man named John Guest. Some of you might know John. He's a brilliant, very gifted evangelist, a great leader, a visionary, and a man who's done a lot of things right. And I could have worked with John forever. In fact, I thought I would work with him forever. And then the old man across the street who I mentioned was named Alf Stanway. Alf Stanway had been a missionary from Australia who went out to East Africa. And he had been out there for 40 years. I'll tell you more about him later. But he had come out of retirement to Pittsburgh to be with us to help us start an Anglican seminary. And so the two leaders were John Guest, he had the vision, and Alf Stanway, who had the experience. And these were two of the most influential men in my life, both with great gifts, both with great wisdom. And sometimes it was like being in between the irresistible force and the immovable force. They were both so strong. And I remember once when they were talking about starting a library. How are we going to get a library once we have some students, once we have a school? And John Guest said, well, we'll put ads in magazines like Christianity Today. We'll put the word out there. We'll say that we're looking for books. And Alf Stanway said, no, we won't do that. He said, we'll pray. Everybody looked at him, really? He said, we'll pray. God will provide for us. So he then led in prayer. The next day, a letter came from a woman in Kentucky whose husband had been a learned professor in a seminary in Kentucky. He had died, and the woman was wondering if she could contribute his vast library to this startup school. That's how the seminary got started. They probably put out some advertisements one day. But Alf knew the wise place to start was in prayer. You recognize a wise person when you realize that you trust their judgment. And that's what you're looking for. Pray for a man or a woman who understands the kind of work you do and who has the gift of wisdom. And when you find that person, spend time with him because he's like gold in your life. Some of you have a lot of confidence in your own judgment. You have to have confidence in your own judgment to be an effective leader. I do myself. I don't take credit for it. I was blessed with a secure and loving childhood. I had wise and godly parents who had a kind and loving marriage. I grew up in North Carolina surrounded by a good, large family. And they saw it that I had a good education. I have had wonderful role models. So I usually have pretty good instincts about things, but not always. And so I always discuss the difficult decisions with my wife, who has more common sense than anybody I know, and political instincts too. And then almost always I'll discuss decisions with one or two others whose perspective helps me. I don't can think of a time when I don't do this. Steve and I have a dear friend named Bill Haley who is on our staff. And he's on our staff not just because he's an excellent preacher and a wise, a thoughtful, spiritual director, but he's on our staff because I value his wisdom. And I want to sit with him and talk with him week in and week out about the things that are going on in our community. Because he has wisdom. And I rarely make decisions without discussing them with him. We don't always agree. But I want to have a wise person or two in my life. I hope you have a wise senior associate or a board member in your organization just to talk things through with when you're hesitant about a decision. A wise leader knows that he needs the wisdom of others. And also, a wise leader needs to have the right attitude about mistakes. Don't be afraid of making mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. You'll say things and do things and you'll make decisions that you regret. You can't avoid it. The really good thing about this is that through those mistakes, we learn wisdom. And a leader who is honest and open about the mistakes that he makes will be loved by his team. And they will learn wisdom together. The whole team will learn wisdom if you're open about your mistakes. One of the blessings of reading biographies is that you can learn from the mistakes of great men and women without actually being there. The other day I was reading about President Woodrow Wilson, and he had an experience that was instructive. It was 1914, and the president had a meeting with a man named Mr. Trotter. And Mr. Trotter was pushy and perhaps not as respectful as he should have been towards the president. And the president lost his temper. And later on, this is what he said about it. Woodrow Wilson said, "I was a damn fool to lose my temper and to point them to the door. What I ought to have done would have been to have listened, restrained my resentment, and when they had finished, to have said to them that, of course, their petition would receive consideration. They would have withdrawn quietly, and no more would have been heard about the matter. But I lost my temper and played the fool." You can love a guy like that. We aren't lacking for leaders in our country, but I sometimes think we're lacking in humble leaders. You know, Abraham Lincoln had rare humility as a national leader, and he understood that he and we are all products of our past and our circumstances, and he denied that Southerners and Northerners were intrinsically different. I love what he said. "They are just what we would be in their situation." Now you think about that. They are just what we would be had we grown up in their situation. That is a wise perspective. Much has been made about Lincoln's team of leaders. He sought the most capable people regardless of things they had said about him. He knew he was strong enough to lead. He wanted the best, and so the leaders that he chose were all rivals, but in those few years, they all became loyal to him. He always defended the team. When they were wrong, he took the blame himself. Last summer, something happened out in Nairobi, Kenya, at the leadership level that I want to tell you about because to me, it's a remarkable example of humility and, I believe, wisdom. It's a story about two of the national leaders out in Kenya. If I could just tell you the story, then I want to show you a little clip. Over 30 years ago, Sam and Lynn Owen, who had been deeply involved in Washington, went back out to East Africa where they had started out as missionaries in the 60s. And they went because of a deep sense of calling to East African leaders, many of whom had been Christians because of the East African revival. But still, these Christians had been terribly divided by tribalism. And these divisions among the tribes of East Africa could be just as fierce, almost as painful as those between Jew and Gentile in the early church. So the Owens wanted quietly to build friendships with leaders and future leaders, particularly in Kenya, and to work to build bridges, bringing men and women together in Christ. And so for years and years, Sam and Lynn developed relationships with political and professional and business leaders, and they brought many of them together in little groups for prayer, for Bible study, for building trusting friendships. And they found that if they could bring people from different tribal backgrounds together into groups like this, gradually they would become more trusting in spite of tribal differences. Now, I myself have visited and been with many of these people over the years, and I've seen a lot of amazing initiatives develop in places like the slums of Nairobi because these men and women came together they began to talk about common concerns, and they acted together in spite of their tribal differences. But in the area of politics, over and over again, we saw tribal differences divide these men and women, even though many were Christians and had even many of them had met repeatedly in little groups in the spirit of Jesus Christ. So democracy is still new to the Kenyans, and whenever election time comes, the old tribal animosity seemed to erupt worse than ever. And this has been true right up to the present. A few years ago, during the lead-up to national elections, there were terrible riots across Kenya, and hundreds of people were killed. So 16 years ago, Sam convinced some of the leaders that they needed to attempt an annual gathering of Kenyan leaders for prayer. And this became the Kenyan National Prayer Breakfast. Gradually, this event has brought together more and more of the leaders, and it has been a time of real inspiration and unity, but some of the leaders have stayed away, and especially around election time. Well, this year, the national elections in Kenya were particularly ugly. The party in power won. However, the opposing party protested the election, so they held a second election, but the opposition leader, Mr. Odinga, pulled out of the second election. And when President Kenyatta was then reelected, Mr. Odinga declared himself the true president in spite of the election. Well, it was a terribly unsettling time for the country, a time of violence and tribal animosity. So the Owens and many others prayed and were working behind the scenes that somehow peace might be restored and there might be reconciliation, something they knew that God wants. For 30 years, our friends have prayed and worked to bring unity through Christ to Kenyan leadership, praying like the persistent widow, you know, and working tirelessly to bring people together. Now, just this past summer, something completely unexpected and utterly surprising has happened. And it seems quite clear to me that God has been at work in the hearts of these leaders. First, some weeks after the election, President Kenyatta asked for a meeting with Mr. Odinga, Raila Odinga, the opposition leader. And out of that meeting, they began to talk about trying to work together, unheard of. Then the president appointed his opponent to be a member of his cabinet. Most people doubted that such a thing could work. And who knows, maybe it won't work. Time will tell. We'll see. But then, a month or so after that, at the prayer breakfast in May, something so unexpected happened that I want you to see the film clip. It's edited down radically, but it shows President Kenyatta and Mr. Odinga apologizing to each other and asking each other's forgiveness for the way in which they had attacked and behaved towards one another during the national election. And when you see them, you can, these men were, they were clearly nervous and uncomfortable. They weren't quite sure how to do this, but they do it. And there are 2,500 people under a big tent at the Nairobi Safari Park Hotel who saw this, and 25 million Kenyans watched it on television. So we're going to watch this clip. I just want you to know the first one up is President Kenyatta.
And I only want to conclude.
He calls his vice president up, and then the opposition leaders.
Come to the stage. Karibu. Don't worry, we're not singing today. You don't have to worry about that. And as I do, I want to invite also my brother Raila and Kalonzo.
These are the opposition leaders now that are coming up.
Welcome for the answer. We have campaigned against one another. We have said nasty things about each other. We have hurt one another. On my behalf, Ndugu, I ask for your forgiveness. Yeah. And I tender my apologies.
Yeah. On behalf of all the members of NASA, I first want to thank my brother Uhuru Kenyatta for what he's just done now. But I just wanted to mention that before we shook hands, we had a very long discussion. We took a journey down the memory lane, where it started. And then we asked ourselves, when did the rain begin to beat us as Kenyans? And we found where the rain began to beat us and when. And we said that we have the ability, working together, to go back down there and reunite the people of Kenya. And they said that the divisions, the hatred, the tension that has existed between our people from all those generations to now will end by with us, the two of us. Never again shall a Kenyan die because of an election. Never again shall a Kenyan deprive a fellow Kenyan of his birthright because of election. And we will also fight corruption together. This is the meaning of the handshake. And we are committed to ensure that the handshake and the MOU that we signed shall be completely implemented to the letter. On behalf of my team, myself, I, in front of this congregation gathered here, pray breakfast, tender my apology to my brother. During our discussions, he accused me of having insulted him. I also told him he also insulted me. He called me Kimundu Muguruki. Apologize.
I talked to people who witnessed this unprecedented act of public reconciliation by the president and his longtime opponent. And they seem to know that something extremely important happened. I know that Washington cynics will look for political reasons for this action, but to those who were there, as one of them commented, she said it was as if God's spirit met the Kenyan leadership in the tent of meeting that day. Now, they won't have a lot of time to do what they want to do. I encourage you to pray for them. I just want to close with this thought. Leaders don't always get a lot of time to accomplish their goals. One of my dearest friends, a friend for over 50 years, worked in the White House for several years, and he told me once of observing out the window of the old executive office building a man walking slowly by on the sidewalk. And in a prior administration, that man had held a major position, was one of the most influential and powerful men in the nation. And as my friend stood there observing, he noticed that as people walked by, crossing his path, going past him, nobody spoke to him. In fact, no one recognized him. No one remembered him. That's the way it is in Washington. Leaders come, leaders go. So much change. And sometimes we wonder just how much good we can possibly achieve in the short time that we have. I mentioned Alf Stanway, the old retired bishop from Australia. He came to Pittsburgh when he was about 69. He was only there for 3 years. He had been a missionary out in East Africa for 40 years, and from the 30s to the 70s. He was the first Anglican bishop of Tanganyika And during the time he was bishop for 20 years, a new church was established on the average of once a week for 20 years. A genuine leader who, in a place where he's allowed to lead and has God's blessing, can make a huge difference. But it doesn't take 20 years. It can happen in a short time, too. We called him in 1976 out of retirement. He came to help us establish an evangelical Anglican seminary. He was only there 3 years. When he came, we had no property, no school, no organization, no board, no faculty, no library, no students. All we had was an idea and a couple $100,000 to help get things going. When he left, 3 years later, there was a school, there were buildings, there was property, there was faculty, there was a board, a library, students, the first graduating class. And most important, a reputation as a solid, established Christian community and a school, and a reputation for thoughtful, wise, honest, prayerful leadership. The school continues. It has grown slowly, steadily, and has trained men and women from around the world for leadership in the Anglican Communion. Alf was only there for 3 years, but 3 years was enough to do what God called him to do. And sometimes wise leaders can do this sort of thing. Whatever time God gives you and me, where you are, treasure it, steward it, and seek to grow in wisdom. As I would sit with this old man, talk to him, and learn from him, I marveled at his faith and wisdom. He had the gift of faith. Maybe the only man I've ever known who had the gift of faith. And a gift of leadership and a gift of extraordinary administrative ability. He would tell me story after story of how God worked and answered prayers. And I knew I didn't have that wonderful gift of faith that he had. But I wondered if there were other things in his life that I might emulate in order to become a wise leader. And there was one thing that I learned for sure. I'll just close with this because time is running out. Our houses were across the street from one another. And on the back of our house, it looked across to the front of the Stanways' house. And so when I would get up in the morning, I would go back to a little unheated studio room on the back of our house. And that was my room. That was where I went to study, to pray, to be alone. And I would go out there every morning at the start of the day. Across the road, up in the top of the Stanways' house, was Alf's study. And every morning, no matter when I got to my room and I looked out across the way, Alf's light was on. And I knew what he was doing. He was praying. He was seeking wisdom from Christ. And every morning I looked at that light and I just thought, God, I want to be like that old man. Maybe you and I can have that kind of impact on some young people. God help us to do so. That's enough for today. Thank you.